London Column. This is Peter Watson once again presenting a weekly radio digest of items headlined or modest, but all selected for your interest and entertainment from the worldwide services of the BBC. London Column. And this week we bring you an official American view on Germany's future. We share in American hospitality to Glasgow children, and we look in on a royal ceremony with an origin lost in the mists of antiquity. And let's start with that last, the Royal Maundy. Every year, on the Thursday of Holy Week, the Royal Maundy is distributed at Westminster Abbey, an occasion at which the King makes presentation of his own symbolic charity to the poor. The ceremony is modest enough, and by far the most colourful participants are the clergy in their ecclesiastical robes. But let's hear the story from one who has just witnessed the Maundy ceremony, our reporter Frank Dash.
At noon today, the King came to Westminster Abbey to perform the age-old rite of Maundy. The word Maundy, by the way, seems to come from the old French word Maundy, commanded, and refers to Christ's words to his disciples, "A new commandment have I given unto you, that ye love one another." The custom of almsgiving and of washing the feet of the poor on Maundy Thursday was mentioned by St. Augustine as having been practiced in England as early as 600 AD. It sprang, quite obviously, from Christ's washing of the disciples' feet on Holy Thursday. Just over 300 years ago, a chronicler wrote, "His Majesty," that is Charles I, "kept his Maundy in the Minster upon the 7th of April. He refrained, however, on that occasion, from washing the poor people's feet on account of the prevalence of plague." This no doubt explains why, this morning, as the King and Queen entered by the great west door of the Abbey, they each received a nosegay of sweet herbs. Then the quaint, colourful procession, headed by the singing choir boys and gentlemen of the Chapel Royal, moved slowly up the nave towards the choir, escorted by gaily uniformed yeomen of the guard, carrying their pikes. One of them carried on his head, for all the world like a market porter, a big silver gilt tray containing purses, from which hung coloured streamers. This fringe of ribbons round the pink faces of the yeomen of the guard gave the whole dignified procession a touch of carnival. Then, first in the nave itself, and then amidst the architectural glories of the choir, came the first distribution of purses, containing gifts of money, green purses for the men and white for the women. The Lord High Almoner, wearing a surplice and girt with a symbolical towel, handed the purses to the King, who walked along the line of aged recipients, making his gifts first to the 55 women, then to the 55 men, as many men and as many women as there are years in the King's life. The second distribution was of the white purses, each containing 55 silver pennies, specially struck for the occasion by the Royal Mint.
Miles north of London and in Scotland's great river Clyde, at this moment two American destroyers are tied up at the docks right in the heart of the city of Glasgow. And the Ernest G. Small and the Charles R. Ware have been the scene of that kind of hospitality that's remembered not just today but for many years to come, an Easter party for some of Glasgow's children. And the best person to tell you about it is our reporter in Glasgow, James Buchan, who speaks from the destroyer Ernest G. Small.
Each child down here on the mess deck has had a huge tray of food put in front of him, and I've got a list here of some of the what the menu contains. Vegetable soup, roast leg of veal, gravy, mashed potatoes, buttered Brussels sprouts, buttered corn, Easter eggs, a huge slice of Easter cake, about 3 inches by 4 inches, I think, candy, ice cream, and coffee. And when I tell you that one young gentleman has just had a second tray put in front of him, you'll gather that children aren't exactly being starved.
Obviously not, if that's the menu. But what do the young guests think about it?
Well, I hear two of the older boys, Robert Wood and William Campbell. Well, Robert, what did you like best about the afternoon?
I liked the penis.
You looked as if you were. And what did you see on the ship?
I saw the guns and saw through the compass, and I saw the thing, write the notes.
Yes.
I think I enjoy the guns best.
You like the guns best?
Yes.
What about you, William?
I enjoyed my dinner.
The dinner?
Yes. And I went around the ship with the sailor.
Mm-hmm. What bit did you like best?
Pardon?
What bit of it did you like best?
The feet.
The feet? And after that, what part of the ship?
Up on the top deck.
Mm-hmm.
And I went down to the sailor's bedroom.
Oh, yes.
Where he sleeps.
Mm-hmm.
They gave me some gum.
Gum, did he? Is that what you're chewing now, is it? What was the most interesting bit of the ship for you?
Well, I enjoyed the guns.
Yes, the guns, the gum, and the party, too. Another and rather grander demonstration of British-American friendship is a regular yearly occasion in London, the annual dinner of the Pilgrims, whose guest of honor this year was Mr. John J. McCly, American High Commissioner for Germany. The crucial need in Europe today, Mr. McCly told the Pilgrims, was the active participation in a united Europe of a Germany made economically self-supporting. But the experience of two world wars had given Germany's neighbors good cause to fear an economically strong Germany, and they must therefore find safeguards by an overriding rule of law to protect themselves against any possible misuse of German strength for aggression. Mr. McCloy explained how these two purposes were to be achieved.
Briefly stated, our German program seeks to achieve security by restricting the power to make war and by encouraging the growth of democracy. This twofold program is wise and necessary. Nevertheless, in my judgment, it is only half the remedy. The other half must be a united Europe of which Germany must be a part. The need for a united Europe is made more urgent by the threat from the East, but it would still be pressing even without that threat. The fact is, we cannot solve the German problem without fitting it into the larger context of a united Europe. The crucial need, then, is for a genuine European community. The demands of security, of economic, and of spiritual health all call for the same solution. Events press us to this solution, and by events, I do not mean merely the East-West split, but the deeper moral, political, and economic forces that surge in Europe today. Many factors call for prompt action. Today, the West has the opportunity to unite for its own defense. Tomorrow may be too late. Today, Germany is still in a formative stage, and I believe wants to join a united Europe. Tomorrow, the situation in Germany and in other countries may have taken a turn which will make action more difficult. Today, the idea of a European community has a strong hold on the minds of the common people throughout the continent. Tomorrow, if steps have not been taken to make this idea a reality, those hopes may be dashed and support for the program may be dissipated. Today, the United States is firmly committed to help Europe and has shown in many ways its hope for the development of a European community. Tomorrow, that interest may decline from the present high level unless it is matched by the interest of others.
Now for London columnist Alan Melville, who has a note on how our Easter parade this year was blown to pieces by the weather. Alan?
This is Alan Melville speaking. Easter weekend is our first national holiday of the year, and normally we make the most of it. The cherry and almond trees are heavy with blossom, the parks are yellow with daffodils, and as Alfred Lord Tennyson so rightly remarked, a livelier iris changes on the burnished dove, whatever that means, and a young man's fancy lightly turns to thoughts of love. And you all know what that means. The ladies parade like cockatoos in Hyde Park, wearing hats which make Carmen Miranda's headgear seem like a dull old felt cloche. And even the hide-bound male has been spotted this Easter in velour millinery of rose pink, sky blue and primrose, led by a dauntless new sect calling themselves the Mad Hatter. Spring, the sweet spring, the year's pleasant king is, so they tell us, with us again. Cold doth not sting, the pretty birds do sing, and as an earlier poet than Alfred Lord Tennyson wound up his charming stanza, cuckoo, jug jug, coo-wee, to wit a woo. This year, however, something went wrong with the works, particularly on Easter Monday, and the cold stang like the very devil. The meteorological pundits having warned us against occasional showers, the clerk of the weather decided to throw in the whole bag of tricks, and gave us gales, rain, hail, snow, thunder, lightning, fog, and just about everything else short of a good-going earthquake. The ladies' hats were whipped from the ladies' heads and may possibly explain any flying saucers you might have seen out your way over the weekend. The gents' netty velours and new flannel trouserings ended up today sodden and mud-bespattered. And even Brumath, the baby polar bear of the London Zoo, and by far the most important living being on these islands today, could only attract a mere 47,000 goggling spectators as compared with the toddler's normal audience of 130,000 on a fine day. Blackpool, which is rather like Coney Island, except that it goes in for a sticky sweetmeat called Blackpool Rock, was hit by a 92 miles an hour hurricane, and its tramcars are reported to have been seen rollicking along the front, bent to an angle of 45 degrees by the gale. At Colwyn Bay, an unfortunate golfer hit a beautiful drive straight into the wind and was promptly knocked unconscious by the ball blowing back and catching him a smart crack on the forehead. Visitors to a hotel in Dover passed a chilly night when the entire roof took off and was last seen airborne over the channel. And the beast at Fleetwood was blown into the high street so that customers and shop assistants alike ploughed their way through 2 feet of golden sand. Outdoor entertainments were deserted, but anything going on undercover did a roaring trade. 100,000 people passed a cosy afternoon staring at the Egyptian mummies in the British Museum, and Edward William Spencer Churchill, 10th Duke of Marlborough, clocked up a dollar a head from 2,400 trippers by throwing open the stately Blenheim Palace to the public, plus a little extra from the sale of guidebooks, pointing out, among other things, the room where Mr. Churchill was born with a silver spoon, if not a cigar, in his mouth. It was, in short, the uncertain glory of an April day, with the theatre managers rubbing their hands in glee and the poor little men who hire out deck chairs in the parks rubbing theirs to keep off frostbite. Goodbye.
Oh, and it's goodbye, too, from this edition of London Column, a radio digest produced by Stephen Eckard, presented by Peter Watson, and which came to you in the North American service of the BBC. That was London Column, a transcribed programme.